following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios, Incorporated.
Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Welcome to another edition from Radioland. You know, I like to do this from time to time. We sat down on the air. I'm going to play you basically the entire podcast was done on the air during an episode of Booze and Blues. Imagine that. But this time is kind of cool because, you know, even though we get to interview some really great people, we had a great guest in that night. And along the way, everybody showed up. It was such a fun evening. We had Martin Shore from Take Me to the River. In there, but here's the really cool thing. We sat down with our good friend Mr. Brad Dunn. Brad is over at American Recording Studios. He is the nephew of Duck Dunn. He's the bass player from the Blues Brothers Band and Booker T and the MGs and all that other stuff. So Diana, Jeff Janowitz, and myself and Brad, we all sat down. This all happened on the air, and we talked about the business of Memphis music. It's a big deal, and this is how it went.
Dee and I were at the Young Avenue Deli last night, and she hooked up with some bass player or drummer or something.
I did
like
not.
That. They hooked up. Look at that.
You know, hey, whatever.
Whatever.
Did you...
I saw the Radio Memphis guitar, which, you know, I got a stiffy over that.
It was actually pretty awesome the way that came out. You know, when we first came in and you went up to the bar and you got in a beer and you got me something to drink. Mm-hmm. And those two guys that were standing there that you were first talking to before you got our drink, right?
Right, right, right.
So you walked away. We got to talk. And you know what was the first thing they asked me?
What was that?
If I was
Are you single?
If I was a Mexican.
Are you serious? ¿Cómo estás, señorita?
¿Es usted un mexicano?
No, and the other guy.
Ah, sí, señor. Muy caliente.
Muy bueno. Caliente. Bueno.
Shut up, Jeff.
¿Dónde están los tatas?
I said, man, God, dude. I sat there, and then you know, one of the guys that was talking, you know, and it turns out that he was half Japanese, half American, and I was like, man,
you're more related to him than you are.
Right, right, you know. And so they're like, so hey,
konnichiwa.
Yeah, so
konnichiwa.
Are you Mexican? I'm like, when the guys love to hear this.
See, but that's exactly why you should perfect your Spanish.
No, I'm not. No,
because
if you spoke
hola,
Spanish,
that's about as
no,
good.
No, but and then didn't let anybody know you spoke it, then if you ever had to disappear, oh.
I'm not going to do it.
I'm just saying.
I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, Brad's over there hooking you up.
Aww,
with something to sit on.
I'm fine, honey. Thank you.
You know, for the folks that are tuned in, we have been honored, absolutely just blessed to have our friend Brad Dunn come in and sit with us this evening. Brad has been very instrumental to the future of this radio station over the past, 4 years since we've been going, since almost the beginning.
Since almost the beginning, yeah.
Pretty much. And listen, I really do appreciate you coming in. I know the Memphis music scene means so much to you.
Absolutely.
You lived it through your family and saw that fight and fought that fight. And just to see that sort of thing had happened was a huge thing.
Very big. In fact, I was just, while we were sitting here talking, I'd gotten a message back from Martin. You know, he was telling everybody, thank you. You know,
we kind of blindsided him on that whole deal.
Yeah, well, we kind of did. But and with the messages that came back, he goes, and especially thank you for having Brad.
Yeah,
that meant a lot. He was like, in his heartfelt, he goes, that meant a lot.
You know, not to take anything away from you, but your uncle was such a big thing. You know.
Yeah, he definitely. He set a benchmark that the rest of my family members, if we all tried together, we could not outdo what he did.
Yeah, but this is going to seem like a stupid question, Brad, and I'm sorry. No, no, but listen, I have had the honor, the pleasure, the fortune to have crossed paths with, you know, not just the Dunn family, but the Phillips family in the course
absolutely.
Of my life, just through, you know, hell, just from growing up around here, to be honest with you, you know, it's not,
just growing
you know,
up, it's a natural,
your connection and, I mean, with select the hits
it's not
and all
just
that.
Your
no,
uncle,
no.
It's your father, it's your uncle, it's, you come from a musical family. You know, when we look at a city like New Orleans, where they've got like the Isley Brothers, there's a whole family of, or like in North Mississippi, you've got the Burnside Clan. You've got a whole family of people that are either they're performers or they're behind the scenes working in the business. But that's kind of the family
together at the same time.
That's the family business, and that's kind of the Memphis way. You know, you don't hear about that in L.A.
You know, and people they still forget. You know, my generation coming up or whatever through the 60s, and even in the documentary, they mention it that, you know, the music industry here in Memphis or Shelby County was the third largest employer.
Right. Yeah. That's so what the city was before FedEx came along.
It was huge. I went to the same school that Isaac Hayes' kids went to, the same school that Charlie Rich's kid, Jack Rich.
Wow.
I went to the same school that...
Dude, when I was 17,
Boo Mitchell.
When I was 17, I was hitting on Steve Cropper's daughter.
Yeah, Stephen Cropper. Yeah. They grew up. Steve's son, Betty Cropper, who not Crocker, but Betty Cropper.
How does Kate's work into this?
My father and her worked together until they both, you know, basically, you know, retired all the way to the end.
Wow.
You once told me, Brad, that you were in the process after Duck's passing. You were trying to catalog everything that he had been in and done and every session that he was there and every tune that was released. And you said that it was quite literally almost an impossible task because he was so prolific in everything. Not just Booker T and the MGs. I mean, that's fairly well documented, but everything. I mean, the stuff he did down here with the Hellhounds and every other artist.
And he did that to, you know, to help Jeff and also to help myself, but he was also integral in coming in the 90s and trying to help. Jeff, his son, went out on tour with, you know, every major act I could ever mention. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of funny when, you know, Satellite first, we'd see things with CNN. You know, I remember a Duck cracking a joke, you know, saying we were at Pete and Sam's, was a place our family always would meet.
Hell yeah.
But yeah. Good stuff right
all
there.
The spinach. Oh, hell yeah.
But the crazy thing was, you know, Jeff was in Russia when they were on the Monsters of Rock tour, and he was watching the television, and CNN was, you know, panned over, and there's Jeff, and he's watching. There's Jeff in Russia, you know. But, you know, what the hell's he doing? He didn't even know he was there, but it just... But those things, it's such a commonplace for all of us that it's a normal thing here in Memphis, and, you know, for so many people to have some sort of connection.
Right.
You know, in Memphis, almost everybody has some sort of Elvis story or some sort of...
Oh, I know, you get those certain generations.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
The Bill Phillips family, as you talked about.
Yeah.
But it is, again, like just the idea of music as a family business, you don't really get that in a lot of places. You do in New Orleans. I'm not saying we're unique this way, but you do in New Orleans. You do where it gets cultural, which is part of the culture.
Yeah. Memphis was a place to come in the 60s and 70s, and even in the 90s, late 80s, I should say. I wouldn't even go late 80s.
Well, there's Stage Stops contributions to the 80s here. Hair rock
absolutely.
That should be a shrine.
Undeniable.
Yeah, there's no doubt about the Stage Stop. What
Nita has done over there is...
Yeah, that is...
There's a shrine for her somewhere.
Yeah, you know? And I've said so many times that there should be... That's a documentary and a story in itself.
It is, because of all the stuff that she's had to come through and all the...
Yeah, Martin should come in and do a thing on Nita.
If you had the financing, you could get a guy like Martin Shore to come in here and do, like, one of those Ken Burns just... You know, like 50-hour documentaries on PBS, 3 hours
a night.
Oh,
like you did with baseball, the whole 9 hours,
of,
you know.
Of
yeah.
Memphis music, because this... You know,
and you still wouldn't get it all in.
No, you wouldn't. You would, because somebody would have the story about somebody else who backed this person that you do know, but you didn't know that guy was on bass or that guy was...
Yeah, Stage Stop, as you mentioned, you know, they went through the part, you know, where she was... When MTV came online, there was bands we'd never heard of, and all of a sudden, whether it be, you know... Tora Tora or Roxy Blue.
Yeah.
All these bands that were playing at,
I'm sorry. We're all remembering, the walls, the bars. And I came across just today. I was telling you, I was eating lunch with John, and we were going through YouTube. We were standing outside in the garage, and we were just kind of playing with some of the music. And there is a video out with Anthony Quarter singing with Sam, Son of Slam.
Really?
And I have to find it.
And it was, I mean,
he said, look, I wanted to tease my hair. I wanted to put on that bustier. And I wanted to go
and throw myself
at him when I heard him start singing. I was like, oh my God. And it's him with Son of Slam.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't mean to make light of a dark topic, but when Jimmy Jameson passed away.
Yeah.
I knew the guy had left an impact by the number of people on Facebook debating about, no, he wouldn't have done drugs. And it doesn't matter. The fact that guy, there were enough people in Memphis that cared about this guy's image.
Yeah, what he did.
Yeah, what he did. Mm-hmm. And that guy,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Jimmy recorded down here as well.
Oh, yeah. Did he?
See?
Yeah, did he?
He sure did.
Have we made a list yet?
No, we're working on that.
Listen, right, and I had to get Rick to give me a copy of Rob Junkless's Memphis thing because you can't find it out there on the internet.
No, Closer to the Flame is the name of the album, and I don't even know where they recorded that.
No, that's one of those lost. Like you probably find it on vinyl at Shangri-La,
Garner maybe.
Yeah, Garner. Yeah.
But you know, definitely having Todd Poole, and his wife.
She's the daughter of Jimmy himself.
Yeah, Jimmy himself. But, you know, now it's so interesting for me that when I walk in, and I'm sure she's reminded of it, or even Todd or some of the different musicians, that the music is becoming classic. And right, that's part, like, right. Even the documentary couldn't even hit their...
The next say, chapter. It's a whole yeah, next chapter. Chapter. I'm saying, you could get Ken Burns in here, and we could... Take you through the decades.
Go on through the next one.
Up till now. Up till right now.
We can take you through every hairdo that ever happened in this room right here.
That's right.
Well, Brad, let me ask you this. You know, you took on a monumental task of rebuilding American, where it is now, on Dedrick and Lamar. And by the way, just a freaking stellar place.
It's a phenomenal studio.
There's a great vibe. There's a great room. You've recreated that sound that's supposed to be there, but you've taken it into the new times.
Hey, can I?
But go ahead.
Let me just interject for our listeners that American is where that Low Society album was recorded.
Yes.
Our Booze and Blues listeners, that Low Society album.
And Mark Millman Massey, did he do that? No, he didn't.
No. That was Ice House Records.
Same record label.
That was done at Arden.
Yeah.
But
Low Society.
But you guys have been done. You guys have been doing so much stuff over there. Movie soundtracks, other bands,
Yeah, and it was a tough, when Leeway moved from this facility and it moved
From
American.
Yeah.
If it was, again, David Gicking coming in, he was one of the first guys, in the group that really saw it and saw that we needed to, recapture. It's American East.
Right.
So we've done the American East website. But, David, he scored the touchdown with it. I protected the building at all cost because
you had to kind of fight off some corporate America stuff to keep it going, right?
I did, and also just the blight thing that was going on in Memphis. They were just knocking down buildings and they didn't know what they were tearing down
For clarification, there was Chips Moman's American Studios and then you guys.
Chips Moment.
What's the difference?
It was American Sound recording,
Elvis was, right?
They had American North, and they had started expanding out so American East had become the Annex, which was called Onyx.
Yes.
And I've heard so many different things about the Onyx name was always left up on the building, and we always believed that was to keep it incognito.
Right.
It was built... right behind an Italian restaurant, which was Grisani's.
Oh, man.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
Everybody knows that name.
There was a gate to the studio.
Right.
We also had...
So it was a clandestine thing? So, like, if Elvis is over there tracking vocals, nobody knows where he's really at.
Whether it would be Elvis or Neil Diamond or any of those folks that would bring in.
Did Neil Diamond come down here?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Neil Diamond, B.J. Thomas.
Hold on.
Well, not in this studio.
Over there.
We're talking about. Because, American was a,
that was a name. I mean, it was a
That was
thing.
A name. Yeah, they had American AGP, American Group Productions. And Chips, what he did, he was one of the first, he actually walked through the doors and found the location for Stax. with Jim Stewart.
So, wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, so when he found the location with Stacks, things weren't, you know, the way Chips would like them to work out. Chips had also worked out at Gold Star, which was, you know, where Richie Valens and all these other people recorded. And he brought that experience.
Wait a minute, Richie Valens also?
Yeah, he worked at the same studio, but he worked with Phil Spector out there at their Gold Star, the Wall of Sound.
La Bamba.
But when Chips came back to Memphis, he worked with Jim Stewart with Stacks, and then saw the need to open up another facility and do more what he wanted to do.
Right.
And
right.
he didn't have a record label, and a lot of people said, well, that's not a good thing later on, him not having a record label. But that also opened the door up for him to be able to record with just any record label in the world, whether it was Columbia, whether it was RCA, even though RCA had their own studios.
CBS or whomever,
So, Brad, when I was coming up, right?
Badco, A&M.
I studied, I went to the University of Memphis while I was part of their music program. at the time, that was something to brag about. The music degree program at University of Memphis is still something to think of.
Yeah, there's been some great Houston, who's in the documentary.
Mid to late 80s, early 90s, and the thing was, like, you know, this is back when everybody knew that, hey, you know, Joe Walsh has a house over on Union, and you know, ZZ Top lives here. You might run into him in a bar. Well, of course, I was too young to go to those bars.
Yeah, Ringo had a place on Parkway.
And so I get to college, and I've got this instructor. Well, the thing is, like, Memphis has always been a music industry town, and we have the technology here that they have in L.A. or New York, but it's way cheaper to record here. You don't have to worry about people finding out you're recording here. A lot of music history happened here because people didn't realize U2 was at Sun Studios cutting an album.
No Union.
Yeah.
That was the thing.
On Union Avenue. And
well, no Union recording either.
Well, and Memphis had its own Music Row, but it's Route 40 cuts through Union Avenue.
Right.
That whole
area. Oh, yeah, okay.
There was Paramount had an office there. I mentioned, you know, King. You know, the other, there was also, I'm trying to think of it, it was Marty Simon.
How long did your dad have King Records?
Well, my dad didn't have King. King Records was the fourth largest record label in the world. They were based out of Ohio.
Oh, really?
And they were the first to actually, they would record a record, they would mix the record, they would master the record.
Wow.
They had their own pressing plants, they had their own graphic arts department, and they would have it sealed and wrapped and ready to go to market. Sid Nathan was probably the very first to actually put together the barcoding system that the record industry used.
Wow.
To stop some of the
pirating. Man, I feel like we're at school.
Well, you know, that's...
Just for me, listening to a lot of the
dinner side conversations, and just hearing somebody talking about what this guy did.
Right.
It's some of it good or bad, but...
But there was a time when that was the...
Record plant.
Nashville kind of seems to be going through this weird... You know, it's not country anymore. Like, Nashville's going mainstream. Right. You know, all the labels have offices in Nashville now.
Yeah,
I can't help but... Well, I want to believe that cannot be anything other than a good thing for us here in Memphis, right? I mean...
Sure. It's got, you know, Memphis actually ruled at one time. 1970, Memphis was a $100 million a year industry.
Right.
Wow.
In the record business.
Wow.
That would convert into the billions now. What Memphis has lost, unfortunately, even Rudy Scheidt, who has been around forever, and he's contributed to the University of Memphis.
Right.
But he said it so many times, what Memphis still lacks is we lack the infrastructure of having a Warner Brothers office here, a Paramount office here.
Well, they all chose Nashville.
Well, we used to. I mean, you know, Paramount had a studio here,
And
Nashville just did it right. I mean, you know, as a Memphian, I want to hate Nashville. I mean, I do.
Yeah.
I do. It's
there's a rivalry,
You can't just drink the water here. You're not have a thing about Nashville. And
there was a time when Nashville was country.
You can't deny there.
Memphis was, you know. What
Nashville? No, Johnny Cash discovered it, you know, and he was working at the old Lit building there on Union. as or Poplar rather, Union. Yeah, it's on Union. Union. Yeah, where Lit is.
Yeah.
That used to be a Cadillac dealership. He was a mechanic down there.
That's right.
And then one day he took his guitar up to Sun and started laying it down.
Yeah, just walking distance.
Nobody talks about that.
Yeah.
Elvis did it as a truck driver for Crown Electric or whoever it was he was working for at the time. But Johnny came up there. Jerry Lee Lewis came up from Senatobia. You know, there was all this stuff that was happening right here.
Well, that's because Sam Phillips had that studio where he'd say, just come on in, pay the day's rate, get an album.
Get a record.
Some people still would argue that, the first really distorted rock and roll record was, cut by...
Rocket 88.
They talked about the story where the amp fell off the car and it was broken. They didn't have another amp, so they plugged it in anyway.
Yeah.
So the speaker was broken, the amp was broken, it was distorted, so they laid it down. First distorted tracks. And
I never thought of that. I never listened to that record version.
But they
didn't have any choice. Like you said, they paid the rate, they got to come in, hey, we're going to record and do it.
And then maybe it didn't even happen the next day, but somewhere down the road, somebody's going, dude, what's that sound? How do you get that sound?
Yeah,
and there's an engineer somewhere going...
It may have been Sam, or it may have been like Chips, or it may have been... Well, there's, even your uncle, would hear a sound. My God, Doc working with, Jesus Christ, he was the backbone of the Blues Brothers, for Christ's sake.
He worked with Tom Petty,
Eric Clapton, Stevie Nicks, the Belladonna record.
When Doc passed away, there was... one of those internet articles about like things you don't know about Duck Dunn or whatever,
and trust me, Brad's read them all.
But the thing is, when you realize how many number one hit singles he was on that you didn't even like, "Want a Man, One Loves a Woman," that was Duck on bass.
There was a lot of people
don't even think about that shit. They don't think about the bass player, but
Well, when they did Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young had got together, I think, their last tour. They were playing at the MGM Grand in Vegas, and they had two sold-out shows. And one of the things that they announced Duck as is the guy who has more gold records than all of us put together.
No doubt.
Is Donald Duck Dunn. So being a sideman, and there's so many sidemen out here that are not talked about a little bit more.
Right.
And I'm glad to see that they're starting to also... whether it be the Grammys or award shows.
They should recognize these guys.
I'm going to take this in a direction. We had a guest on here within the last 2 years who will remain unnamed for the purposes of the broadcast. I'll tell you off air. No big deal. But he talked about like an attempt in the 80s to unionize musicians on Beale Street.
And his whole picture,
because you're about my age, and the picture, he's older than us, right? You and I weren't hanging on Beale Street in the 80s. I would have loved to have been. Late 80s, yes. Late 80s, but
Yeah, I was I was talking to Diana earlier.
Yeah.
Because the Beale Street really didn't come alive.
No.
I graduated high school in 81 would have been my year.
You are older than I thought you were.
Oh my God, Jeff! What the way?
The drinking age was different. No.
God damn!
No, I thought we were about the same age. I didn't know
that. Yeah, we were talking about Beale Street.
So the picture that this guest painted of Beale Street was back in the '80s. Memphis was a town of sidemen. It was the town where the people that backed BB on tour, that backed. You name the artist, they played with them. They were playing on Beale Street professional fee. They were making serious cash to be able to make a living. Not like they were filthy, stinking rich, but they were making a living as musicians on Beale Street. And then in the late 80s, all the Beale Street club owners, I'm going to bite the hand that feeds this, aren't I?
Well, they
kind of realized that, hey, we can get these part-time band people in here and give them beer.
They had
to
be able to, because again, the cost to redo these clubs
right.
at that point it was all about how do you self finance.
I'm not casting blame, but he's no, so what that, happened is all these pro cats either quit playing on Beale and ended up wasting away here, or they got the hell out of Memphis. They went for parts unknown, New Orleans, L.A., just Nashville, anywhere they can go get gigs and get paid.
Yeah, well, they had to move around. One thing Memphis did have, it had a local union. Nashville has a union, L.A., New York.
There was a Memphis Songwriters Union, I think, for a while.
Yeah, Memphis Songwriters Union, the NSA, which Everett, they kept alive for a while. And I know a gentleman named Philip Beasley helped revive it. Y'all probably met Philip. But just guys like that, because Estelle Axton had started the Memphis Songwriters Association, and I think one of the first guys to run it was Keith Sykes. And, you know, there's just that's another name, Keith Sykes. You know, there's...
But, you know, that's another thing, though, too, with the... I even read an article about this about a month ago that talking about how the songwriter as a profession is drying up even in Nashville. You know, where guys used to make a living...
Sure.
Guys or gals used to make a living just penning songs for other people. The changing face of the music industry has just kind of done away with that, you know.
It's definitely changing, and yes, having songwriters, like, you know, where there was just tons of songs
here, right,
take my song, pitching a song. Yeah, it has changed so much. But one day we'll see another, and a lot of people don't even realize, like, you know, back to Elvis, which, I mean, to me, he's what everything was created around and after.
Oh, we're all standing on his shoulders,
yeah,
without a doubt. Yeah,
but you know, Elvis, you know, he didn't write his own material. He didn't write any of his own songs.
No, so he didn't.
He didn't have a single recorded song that he wrote.
Exactly, and so there's
more
entertainers that pick it up and start covering other songs. But I think for anyone, if you have written a song, that's probably one of the biggest.
Yeah, but we saw them. All of us in this room saw the music industry take that weird turn where, at one time, it was acceptable to be like, yeah, I might not sing it well, but I can write a song. But this girl over here, or this guy over here, going to sing the shit out of it.
Right.
But we went from that to, well,
these people
they're gonna have to lip sync it because they have the look. They don't necessarily have the voice.
When they got the look, it became a visual instead of a content thing.
Yeah,
TV kind of
helped with that.
Yeah,
as we know
video.
Yeah, because we've all seen it where you've had artists that come into a studio on straight up image only.
Yep.
And it doesn't translate. You know, you hear
look what MTV did to bands like Mountain. All of a sudden you realize Leslie West is a big old pookie who doesn't look good on camera and
yeah, but we've created Kanye West, which has got a staff of writers to write four lines.
Absolutely.
And auto-tune and production is boom, boom, it's done.
You know, Dave Chappelle, when he was on Inside the Actor's Studio, once said that, you know, the thing about Hollywood is it's where art meets industry. It's the same thing with music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to have those people trying to make money in order to sustain those people trying to create art.
Sure.
And it creates for a... It causes a weird intersection of just shit, man. I mean,
at American, you guys must fight that fight almost all the time.
Well, one of the things with American is that we get people that email us from all around the world or send us Facebook messages thinking that it's the same way when the Memphis Boys were.
Yeah.
The old days.
The Memphis Boys was Chip's Moman's, you know, house band.
Sure.
Similar to...
They were the Hitmen, yeah.
Yeah, like Booker T and the MGs. Yeah. But they were the Hit Factory, or the Wrecking Crew, excuse me.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the Wrecking Crew, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, then guys like, Bobby Wood went on and recorded, he wrote the book Amongst Giants or Walking with Giants. And then Robin Jones also wrote a book about American, but it's basically about the Memphis Boys and these guys who backed up, you know, all of these killer artists. It's really hard.
Now, let me see if I can find a bass player for you.
Put that together for you. Yeah. But they're not where they just show up every day.
But that's a good point, though, because you hear about how Stax or Berkeley is going to teach that Memphis style of music. We're going to put the same. Well, I know Stax does it by putting the same lineup as Booker T and the MGs. I don't know if that necessarily means that they have to be half black or half white. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I think they just whoever can play.
But it's the same instrumental lineup. How do you?
Yeah, I think they try to do a Barcaise. They try to, you know.
But again, can you imagine like having
the
horns, a house band?
I want the rhythm section. I want that bounce. I want that Memphis.
Is there a house band now, or is it just like a house directory? Like these are the people we call when we need somebody to come in and punch in some keyboards.
Now it's like you said, it's session musicians that you can call.
That's
guys like I would say, you know. Yeah, Rick Steff, who gets a lot of, you know, calls. But
yeah, you bring it. Yeah, Rick Steff, he made that appearance on the Low Society record.
Yeah,
Because Sturgis was like, hey, listen, I need some keyboards, I need some accordion. I think is where it really came down. It was accordion. And somebody, whether it was you or Will or somebody,
Will had gotten contact.
He said, "Hey, let me get Rick over here and let's slide this down." And All of a sudden, there was this whole door that opened. It's like, yeah, this is session work. It's not like there's a stable of. There's like an orchestra sitting in the back corner somewhere going, okay, give me some charts and we're ready to go. It doesn't happen anymore, you know?
Well, there was a time when I wanted to be a session guitar player. That was my goal in life.
I mean, a lot of the session players, I mean, they actually make a very, very awesome living.
They can, yeah.
I got to imagine that as a career.
Mm-hmm. But they're like B actors.
Is
wiggling
away,
you know?
Just like yeah.
They're actually doing. You know, Nashville would be the place if you were going to be a session player to go. That's still, they're seeing that still work, but again, it's nothing like it used to be.
Right?
No, there's not a. You don't call up the American Studios, house band.
You kind of see it in the blues scene here locally, but it's almost like the way hip hop does, like a single featuring Kanye. You'll see like Ghost Town's put it on their new album. They've got a track with Brandon Santini playing harmonica.
Right.
You know, there's that crossover, but
there's no session work in there. You know.
Well, right. And then you're seeing.
I'm pretty sure Brandon Santini sees that as session work.
But he's being featured.
Oh well, so no, he's happy to do it. Yeah, but you don't have that.
And people, instead of coming, they'll do the Skype sessions. They'll send files over the internet. So, I still think some of the things Diana was talking about, this documentary is really inspired, is just getting people back into the room and everybody recording. You don't have a lot of time to overthink it and spend all this time, sitting here trying to polish up a record. You just
getting into the spirit of it and the spirit of the city.
If you're talented and you've got what is going on, it's you don't even think of things like that. You don't auto-tune is not an option.
Well,
you don't think you should come in, plug and play.
You see this on a constant basis with the metal show Monday nights on Radio Memphis. Metal is one of those things. It's there's a real funny vibe to it. It's either really really good or really really bad. There's no middle ground to it. There really isn't. And thankfully it's the really bad part is very very shallow. there's not that many bands that are really bad.
Right.
You have a lot of guys that can really knock it out, and you see that. But these guys are not into auto-tune. But they're being creative.
They're being creative, and
being different, and that's key.
And I'm here to tell you, and I can't even remember who I was talking about this with, and I don't know if it was with one of you guys and stuff. The next major metal musician, that's going to hit it big.
Mm-hmm.
Their background is not metal. Their background is going to be something
more often
from
than
blues
not, it's
or
classical.
Jazz.
Yes, classical. That's exactly what I was thinking.
And understanding and stuff. But they have the abilities to be. They have to have the abilities to be able to sit in and kind of roll with it and plug and play too. Yes,
sure.
For blues, I mean, and blues is essentially the groundwork and foundation for everybody else. I mean, that's why everybody's so tuned in.
Well, blues is performed and it's crossover.
Blues is a performed art, though. We've talked about this before.
Sure, but it's also crossover is the way to go.
Well, absolutely. It's funny. Not last year, maybe the year before, we had asked. We used to ask that question: what's the state of blues? It's funny we don't ask that anymore because I think blues has a real shot now.
It does, yeah.
It does.
There's no need to ask that question
because
there's a jam every...
Because of the internet, there's a chance for it to find its audience.
Six and seven nights a week, there's a jam,
Well, I'm not just talking about locally, Rick. I mean, I went to a thing like 4 or 5 years ago. Reverb Nation put on this seminar here in Memphis, and they kind of laid out, by genre, what is the easiest... Not easiest, financially, just pure numbers. What's the cheapest... genre you can break a band or break a musical act in.
Really? Jazz.
Yes. No. Gospel.
Gospel.
Audience is always there. That's a selective hits mixer. That's how they keep the lights on. Gospel. Because people who love music and want to get a little God in them, it's not about the artist. It's about the music. Next.
Cheap to produce.
Second easiest, though. Second cheapest. Blues.
Really?
Because the same reason, the audience is there. The audience wants that. They actively seek that music out. It's not. They will latch onto an artist that they like, but it's not so much about, I only listen to blues if it's Muddy Waters. It's not like that. Mm. All right. Now, on the other end of the coin, you've got pop music, hip hop, and rock, which are the most expensive. And by expensive, I mean how much money you would have to spend to get an artist to become profitable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, talk to that man over here.
So leap forward. Now, what with the changing face of the internet, which is focusing more on local, it's focusing more on personal tastes, right? Sure you Google is. Something, it's kind of got a suggestion for what you're looking for, even if it doesn't find what you want. It makes sense that there's a future for these genres, like blues, gospel, where the audience is there, they're waiting, they're ready, they want it, okay?
It's a never-ending supply.
It's a never-ending supply.
Things are different. Things are not the same as they were back in the day. They're not the same.
But back to my point, there was a time when on this show we would ask somebody, what do you think the future of blues is? And, oh, I don't know, man. It's kind of grim. It's kind of, you know.
The musicians, and look, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot, you know, and by saying it, you know, what those artists, you know, like the Ducks and, you know, and all of that we've been talking about all night, you know, what they came to the table with.
The Ducks?
You know.
The Duns?
Yeah. Ducks, Steve Cropper, you know.
Yeah. Howard Jackson, Scrooge.
All of those.
You know, the guys that weren't wearing any pants.
Absolutely, yeah, man. That's where my mind is always at.
Carol Kay out in California. I don't know if y'all know Carol Kay.
Yep.
Carol Kay. Yeah.
My God, you know. What, 30,000 or 40,000 sessions? I lost track, you know, trying to count her sessions.
Same thing with Duck. You can't count what he did.
Right, because the things that were... There's so many things that just hit the vault and never got put out.
Right.
Oh, my God. So there's some jewels. There's some gold.
Yeah, apparently. There's a lot of things. Certain record labels have purchased those. And I tell you who has a tremendous vault of material that has not been heard. And that is at Royal Studios.
Oh, no doubt. They've
got it involved.
They're probably sitting on some serious
stuff. I've had the opportunity to listen to some of the stuff that Selected is sitting on, and it would blow your mind.
Well, and I can tell you also, Eric Cruz, whose father was owner of American Sound Studios, he's got all the masters going back from when American was opened in 64 to when it closed out of Memphis in 72. They went to Nashville. I think he finally shut it down. I know they shut studio down as Onyx in 78, but having those masters, but he told me, I've got a version of Alex Chilton singing Suspicious Minds. And he's got so many different versions of different singers singing all these classic, you know, The Letter, different versions of artists singing these things, these songs. So there's so much stuff that's, you know, it needs to be restored, and we're seeing more and more of that being restored. Like, you know, bring up Jeff Powell's name. I know.
There you go.
Yeah, Jeff Powell just has done a great job with, you know, Concord Records. He did, it was Greg Allman's record and maybe some of the Allman Brothers. But I just was looking the other day, and they had sent him a version of the picture disc on vinyl. And but, you know, Arden also has a great their vault. They have some really killer material.
That's
in
like
vault.
The Vatican vault right there. You don't know what's in there.
Yeah, so there's a lot.
Life-changing stuff.
There's some stuff lurking about in there.
We were talking the other day, I think all of us, that a lot of record labels now are working on their catalogs to preserve those and also to promote those.
Right.
And then you talk about blues. There's no telling. Record one night, and those tapes go in.
Well, I remember, look, coming up in the early 90s as a student of jazz, you know, all the teachers, all the older guys that are my age now, or I'm their age now, they would tell you, you know, if you get into jazz, you really get into it, there's going to be stuff you'll never find on CD or cassette or A-track. Yeah. You have to find the vinyl.
Right.
And that hasn't changed. I mean, yeah, a lot of stuff got converted to digital, but not all of it.
Well, you know, Best Buy is selling turntables now, and quarter-inch tape decks are starting to come back.
Oh, yeah, they're there. Yeah.
You can, you know, you can put literally 4 hours worth of music on a quarter-inch reel.
Wow.
You know, y'all saw me earlier on my you know, looking on whether it be eBay or Amazon, but I saw, you know, some fresh sealed copies of Zeppelin and Rolling Stones that has never been opened, and they're selling for $120 to $1,200 for a reel, because these audiophiles, some people would prefer to listen to it on the tape.
You know, we mentioned Son of Slam earlier. Mm-hmm. The only Son of Slam record, there's a copy available on eBay for $320.
Wow, yep. See?
Sure is.
$320.
Sure is.
So,
and I bet every member of Son of Slam still wishes they had a case in the garage of those albums.
Exactly. Well, I have a little closer insight on, you know.
I'm just saying. You know, that was, look, I've been there. I understand it.
It's weird and tricky. But Brad.
This could go on forever and ever, so we could talk about, you know.
Sure, and I got to stop here. Brad, thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely, Rick.
It's great that you're a part of our family, and we're deeply honored to have you, you know, here in this room that you built.
Definitely,
you know, we're glad to be just a tenant. We're paying rent in your world. The old joke, you know, it's, you know, I'm just living in Brad's
well, you're not, you know,
squirrel trying to get a nut.
I appreciate what you guys are doing, though, to promote so many artists out here and bands that, you know, they need this outlet to be able to be played on the radio. And
we joke that, you know, that Duck would have wanted a radio station like this.
Sure,
absolutely.
You know, and we joke about it because, you know, had he lived just a little bit longer, he would have seen it, and it would have been a great honor for me, especially to have your uncle down here to see it, you know, really come to fruition.
Yeah, definitely. I can remember, you know, just, you know, when I come down here, just the memories, the trips when he came here, and you know, even my father, King had a record store chain. They even had their own stores.
Yeah,
but it was called Blue Note Records.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier, Jeff was talking about, you know, blues, but
I just knocked my headphones off because I remember that.
So just blew it right off your head. Yeah.
Gary Bell's moved House of Blues. We all heard about him moving Studio D down Highway. Was it 64? I believe
61.
61. Yeah.
Not get straight on that, but thank you. But
hey, the reason I know.
Hey, was able to move the studio on a trailer. I mean, literally pick it up and
just shift it right down the road
all the way to Nashville. And now here's, you know, Dan Aykroyd. Yeah, 64.
You were right.
Yeah, but they shipped the studio, the other part that couldn't be moved, and I'm not sure who just took over. I think the guys that were in Egypt Central.
Mm-hmm.
So they're relaunching the old House of Blues, which it was originally built as Sounds of Memphis or Beautiful Sounds. It was called those two names, but originally it was Sounds of Memphis, and Sounds of Memphis and the American East location were the only two purpose-built studios in Memphis. That one was built probably the turn around 1960. Then American East or Onyx would be in 67. But then you talk about Phillips Recording.
Right.
Beautiful, wonderful place. They took an old bread factory and they turned it into a, you know, a very legendary studio.
Yeah,
so we're just kind of touching on the tip of the iceberg where there's studios, artists. And
you need to write a book, Brad.
Right. Jesus.
Well, I have been talking
or
about
start
that.
Or start a podcast or something.
Something.
Yeah, have
podcast.
Yeah, podcaster. I already have the title of my book. I've talked about it a few times, but we'll save it for another day.
Yeah, don't put it out there. Somebody will steal it. Yeah,
it's called Go Fuck Yourselves. That's what it is.
Yeah. Here's what's coming up on the next episode with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
I have my headphones, so I'm listening to the mic on the board, you know. But it was recording the damn thing off my webcam, and it looked great, but it sounded like sugared asshole. It was horrible. And once again, it's filled with the same anger and just depression and vitriol that you find at any other one of these places. But here's the big difference they have for you over there. They've actually got somebody who will take your keys and eyeball it and make a perfect copy of what. How many keys do you need, sir?
we have the decorative kitty cat keys if you want them, but I know I see you want just the plain key, sir. Yes, I would. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. There's a thought. Yeah, imagine that. Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. You can subscribe to the show through iTunes, Player.fm, TuneIn, and Stitcher. You can also listen online and download past episodes at radio-memphis.com.
But again, I'm so thankful every time, you know, I plug in to your guys' app and I listen to all this, you know, just unbelievable music that you guys are putting out there and playing. And
well, we appreciate you being a part of all this and helping us out.
And for everyone listening, you know, do what you can to support, you know, Radio Memphis, because, you know, they also realize they have to play local artists, but this radio station is being, you know, broadcast around the world.
Yeah, it is.
And let's face it, you know, the 2015 cars, 2016 automobiles are all going to have Wi-Fi
in it. That's
right. Some of the cars aren't even having CD players in it.
AM and FM is an optional standard in
Chevy.
Where
you saw where Memphis was, was it the metal scene, Diana, that was named, or the rock scene that was named one of the top five cities to watch in 2015 for their music scene?
The underground scene, stuff like that.
The underground is definitely coming in alive and well, and it doesn't get much more underground.
Because you know what? You can't get this stuff anywhere else.
No,
you can't.
They're waiting. 2015. They're waiting for Memphis underground scene to blow up.
Yeah. I think we're all on the cusp. I think things we've talked about on air and off air. There's things happening. There's
the crosstown scene over there with Pete Matthews, who used to be in the studio, and who's Rick had, you know, worked with and negotiated a deal to move in here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Hilo Recording that's over on. It used crosstown.
Yeah, we're in Cleveland. Yeah,
it used to be Mastercraft Studios was all in there. But there's so much going on. And right before Pete left here, talking about blues, the Jarvis Singleton record was cut here. And I believe that's the number one record of 2014.
Add that to your
blues.
List. Come on.
On Alligator Records.
Jarvis.
I think it's
Jericho Singleton.
Jericho
Singleton. Please, forgive me. I can't remember everything. It's a Sunday night.
I had to make sure I was
hear about
right
it right now.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got to get that list going. We have that safe here that we can't open, but I have a way to get into it. I'll tell you about that later.
He's hired an old safecracker from Kentucky from back
in the day. No, I can get the combination sent to me, and we'll get it there. And I'm dying to know what. I think there may be a list of, you know, people that owe somebody some money.
Brad, I got to ask you this, because I know you are a mover and a shaker behind the scenes. You come from a musical family. Did you ever pick up an instrument and play that thing?
I used to play it all the time, but... You know, for me, my legacy more is following in, like, in my father's footsteps on the business side. And on my mother's side also, I have two uncles that worked. One worked for Warner Brothers and the other one worked for Paramount. One actually was in Nashville and the other one worked out of New York. And, you know, I still enjoy playing music.
Right.
I put out a few records, played in bands.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's hard to be everything to everybody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's tough.
You know, I find the biggest enjoyment is when a young band walks in, or even an older band that's really never had the opportunity to record.
There you go.
Or put the whole thing together and see the smile on their face. And
if it sells
a million or sells zero, it's the experience they get to take with them on this ride.
That's huge.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, thank you again, guys.
Brad, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I appreciate it deeply.
So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed it. It was a fun experience to sit down with Brad. Brad's been a great friend of ours since, like, since day one of the station. We were able to do a lot of really cool stuff with him, and it's just a fantastic experience to just a great opportunity to sit down with such a fun guy as Brad, and such a knowledgeable guy. He's been all over the place. He actually met the Beatles. We'll just save that for a whole other episode, and maybe one time. Jeff and I will sit down with him and we'll do another chat. You could talk with the guy for hours and learn so much about the business of music. It was fantastic. It was a great experience. And here it was that we were able to share with you. Hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to share it and tell everybody you know about it. And remember to keep part of this. Keep sharing and keep listening to this podcast. Good God Almighty, you'd think I was drunk. Oh, it was so much fun. So there you have it. We'll see you next time. You heard what's coming up next, and there's that. I'm Rick Cheddar, and this has been From Radioland.
proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios, Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more audio on demand, go to radio-memphis.com.